Hello, listeners of Four Courses with Jeffrey Zakarian. It's your host, Jeffrey. I'm here today to share a very special announcement. One thing you may know about me from social media is that I love meeting my friends from the food world at events around the country. And I've even made it an annual ritual to interview many of them at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival in Miami. So, for the rest of this summer, we'll be bringing you our summer series, From the Beach. Each Friday, we'll be publishing short and intimate conversations that I've had with some of the top talent in the food world and even beyond. The conversations you'll hear for the next 6 weeks were recorded poolside at the W Hotel in South Beach, as my friends and I enjoyed great cigars and magnums of rosé as we discussed our past, present, and future. Without further delay, please enjoy Summer Series From the Beach with Chef Bobby Flay.
But I'll tell you something that happened there. So every night I always felt like I was literally drowning. I was sweating in the worst way because I was just trying to keep up. And the restaurant was busy. And this guy walks in and he's like, "Is this the chef?" And the owner says, "Yeah, this is Bobby Flay." He looked at me and he goes, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Yeah." It was Jonathan Waxman.
Wow.
He had just opened Jams. And then I went to work for Jonathan for 3 years.
After that?
Yep.
So you quit this job and you went to Jonathan Waxman?
I went to work for Jonathan. I threw away the title and the better than average salary, and I went to learn how to cook. He was the first person to teach me about good food. It was a different world. I didn't know it existed. I didn't.
Wow. Jonathan Waxman was on, I think it was on the Upper East Side in the 70s, right?
Jams, 79th Jams. Street off Lexington.
Who else was working there with you?
Oh, my God. I mean, honestly, I worked at Jams and Buds and Hulot's, which was a French bistro that Jonathan
owned.
I worked in all the restaurants. Every single cook there, Jeffrey, was like unbelievable. I mean, any one of those people could have run their own restaurants. Everybody.
And Jonathan was a West Coast chef, and he had just come to New York to
open. He was the first person to bring California ingredients and cuisine. And that's where I learned all about the Southwestern ingredients. It was the first time I saw a blue corn that wasn't in a bag. And all the fresh and dried chilies. That's how I got intoxicated to open Mesa Grill.
I mean, we're talking probably 15 years way ahead of its time. I mean, you're talking about the 80s.
Yeah, mid-80s.
Mid-80s. So Jonathan really seems to me like, for me, it's not just for you, for a lot of people, he was the like kickstarter for a lot of incredible careers.
Yeah, and Jonathan has the same attitude today that he had then, which was like, he was like very laid back.
It's hard to believe.
No, seriously, like really laid back, and he was just like, so let's take like some like acacia honey and put some like lime in it and make a dressing and then put some arugula on top of the chicken. All right, Bobby, all right, that's what we're gonna do. Like that's literally how he creates dishes. You know, it's insane, but he does it the same way today.
I don't think he's ever going to have a heart attack at all.
No.
He's just going to fall asleep one day, and that's going to be the end of him.
It's the Salsa Verde diet.
It's the Salsa Verde diet, right? So that was like an incredible turning point for you. And then tell me about Miracle Grill and how that sort of happened. And when did that happen? Because Miracle Grill, to me, was like where you were sort of discovered, even though you've been working your butt off.
Miracle Grill was a restaurant in the East Village when the East Village was not a safe place to be.
Not at all.
I mean, and I had really started to discover that I love Southwestern ingredients based on working for Jonathan. And I was working as a line cook just to make a living in some kind of like cheesy restaurant. And the person on the line next to me said she was opening a restaurant. So I just thought she was the chef. And it turned out she really needed a chef. And she wanted to open a Mexican restaurant. And I said, "Well, I'd like to be considered, but I'm not cooking Mexican food. I'm gonna cook something called Southwestern." And she's like, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, it's a contemporary version of what Mexican ingredients can lend."
What year was this?
This was 1988.
That's incredible. I mean, that's...
And anyway, long story short, she said, "We're hiring a sous chef. We've already hired a chef." The chef was a woman from Arcadia who had worked at Arcadia, and she was going to hire her. And I said, "Well, let me cook for you." So I cooked her basically food that I learned cooking at Bud's, which was Jonathan's Southwestern restaurant, that I cooked at. And they were like, "We'd like to offer you the sous chef job." I said, "Nope, I don't want it." They're like, "What do you mean?" I was like, I want to be the chef somewhere. And they're like, "Okay, well, we don't have that job." 2 days later, they called me. They're like, "All right, we want to offer you the chef job." So that was the beginning of Miracle Grill, and I was the chef there for 3 years.
3 years. And when did you get the bread? Who walked in?
Jerry Kretschmer walked in, who owns Gotham Bar and Grill, and came in and ate dinner. And on the way out, because Miracle Grill just had like a little like window.
Yeah, I remember.
You know, like a little diner window. Yeah. You know, that was the kitchen. It was three of us, did everything. And he looked at me and he said, "How old are you?" And I was like, "I'm 22. No, I was 23 at the time. He's like, "You're 23? I said, yeah. He goes, you're just a baby, and walks out. And after he'd eaten, didn't say it was great, nothing. And then like 3 days later, I get a phone call, you know, somebody wants to talk to you about opening a restaurant.
At 23, what kind of deal did you sign? How did you know what a non-disturbance, how did you know what all the, how did you know what kind of deal to cut for yourself? Because I'm still trying to learn that.
Well, my dad has always been really good in business and always has always, like, you know, sort of kept me in line in terms of, like, his like, motto is, like, you know, just do the right thing. You know what that means. Just do what you're supposed to do. Don't try to make every nickel.
Nope.
You know, the whole thing. That's his very conservative philosophy, which has been really an important part of my life. And it makes you stay the course in the right way. And Jerry was really excellent to me because he's like, look, here's the way it's going to work. I'll never forget this. He said, we're doing this together. I'm going to take care of the financing. I'm going to sign the bank loan. You're going to create the menu. We're going to design the restaurant together. And I'm going to get you the ink. That's what he said, the ink.
Press.
Yeah.
He kept his word.
He kept his word.
And you kept your word.
Exactly. And we got along because we were both total native New Yorkers. And he said, I'm going to give you a salary, and I'm going to give you 5% of the restaurant to start.
5%.
To start. And then I'm going to give you 5% over the next 3 or 4 years until you get to 20 or 25%. But you work into it. You don't have to put up a penny. And you'll make an okay living salary-wise, so you can like live like a human being. But you're going to have to work to make your living. Jerry has been was an amazing mentor to me.
Is he still a partner of yours?
Yes, he still is a partner of mine in Mesa Grill in Las Vegas.
In Las Vegas.
Yes.
And everything else, you and Lawrence, your other partner.
Me and Lawrence, who's Jerry's son.
That's an incredibly generous deal, if you ask me.
Well, 100%, but like it's a smart deal on his part too. And I think about that when I'm talking to people that I'm hiring. You want people to be happy. I mean, it's not worth it. Like, to try to beat, like, I always say in negotiation, I like negotiating. I do it all the time. And the thing about a negotiation, at the end of the day, both parties have to be happy and have to have a little pinch.
Yep.
Because otherwise, if somebody just absolutely beat you to a pulp, you're not going to be happy about it. It's not going to work.
No, you're going to wake up every morning, go work 100-hour weeks.
No, it's not
and
good.
Feel like shit.
It's not worth it.
Because you don't have the right deal structure, and you're going to resent it every day you walk in, and you're going to think about it, and then you become a bad partner, and then the problems happen, and you can't get out of this, you can't get out of that.
Right.
It's just awful. And it's very rare to find, I think, talk about performance, it's really very hard to find a partner that really understands that. Where you're going to do this, I'm going to do this together. We're going to make money, but we're not going to make it right away. We're going to do something great together. That's hard, especially in New York City, because it's so expensive.
Yeah, and then also I met Lawrence, Jerry's son,
a lifelong friend.
That day, well, he's been my business partner and best friend for 35 years.
That's incredible.
I mean, you don't find that. You don't find a business partner that lasts that long that you can, you know, go through the wars and high-five the victories.
So how old were you when you opened Mesa Grill? Your first...
25.
So you're 25. You're a chef partner of one of the most successful restaurants in New York City. You didn't know yet what was going to happen.
No.
You sort of blew the lid off of food because there was no one in New York City. I remember specifically that restaurant. Nobody serving what you were serving. Not even close. Maybe on the West Coast, Mark...
Not on the East Coast.
Not in the East Coast.
Well, actually, Arizona 206.
Yes.
Brendan Walsh did a really great job.
Great job.
I mean, honestly, really great job.
But that's two restaurants out of 25,000.
No, exactly.
I mean, that's kind of like, you know, and what's happened now is like every corner is trying to like replicate some of the stuff you did. I remember coming to your restaurant, and I just opened probably the Royalton. 44th.
You were at the 44th.
The Royalton.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was doing kind of upper level French food. And I would watch the food come out of the kitchen. You would do numbers there. I'm like, how do you do all these covers?
Yeah, 300 and 400 covers
a
night.
I mean, I couldn't believe it. And you said to me, the difference between my cuisine, Jeffrey, and your cuisine is you do this.
Yeah.
And I do
right
this, which is like two steps versus six steps.
No, I know. I mean, your food is so beautiful and intricate.
Well, yeah, but we try to do it like that, but it's really come down to, like, I think today...
Your food's obviously gotten simpler over
way
time.
Simpler, just because I want to eat simpler. It's not because, well, the light did go off, but it was like, it's called the labor light. You're performing now as a 25-year-old. With your own restaurant, and then the greatest thing that ever happened to you was probably someone walked in the door from Food Network. How'd that happen?
Food Network?
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, Food Network was a startup cable channel.
Yeah, in Midtown, right?
They had a studio on, I'm going to say, like 38th Street. No, the first one was like on 38th Street and like 11th Avenue.
Yeah.
And they were like, it was ugly. I mean, it was ugly. And they had no money. So basically, if you didn't live in New York and couldn't get there by taxi, you were not going to be on the Food Network. They were not flying you in from L.A. to be on Food Network. That's for sure. They had no money.
So it was David Rosengarten in the beginning? Who was it?
Well, David Rosengarten was there.
Right.
And then Robin Leach had a show with a woman named Kate Connolly, who was his sidekick. It was not a good show. I'm just going to say that. And when I say it wasn't good, it was really kind of funny because Robin would go to the Knicks game. He was a huge Knicks fan. And he would come after having a couple of cocktails at the Knicks game. Like, the show was on at 11 o'clock or midnight live for an hour. And he would have, like, C celebrities on. Because who's going to go at 11 o'clock on 38th Street and 11th for the Food Network? Nobody even heard of the Food Network.
Yeah.
And he would interview them for, like, 45 minutes. And then the last 15 minutes. Could you imagine a 15-minute food segment on the Today Show?
That was, yeah, never.
That's
huge.
Live?
It's like so much can go wrong.
He had this sidekick, this incredibly upbeat, very beautiful woman named Kate Connolly, and she would do the food segments with the chef. Would there be a chef like from New York somewhere who would like basically take the subway to get there, and they would do these food segments. And so I did a couple of those, and then Kate and I, you know, got a little friendly, and we started dating, and then we had a kid.
Wow.
That's exactly how it went. Obviously, like, so serendipitous. It's like, it's opened up so many amazing doors in my life. It's crazy.
I don't know any other chef that owns horses, race horses. Where did that happen? Like, I'm okay.
My grandfather, Willie Flay.
Willie Flay.
He took me to Saratoga. And if you haven't been to Saratoga Springs,
it's beautiful.
During this race meet, there's really something very magical about
it's beautiful.
It's a beautiful place. And so not everything about horse racing is Saratoga Springs, but that's the thing that we all gravitate to and try to think about in that business. And now, I mean, I'm in the business. We breed horses, we race.
Where do you
them.
Breed horses?
Kentucky.
Kentucky.
Yeah.
So describe like how that works, because it sounds so daunting and expensive and like complicated.
Yeah, it is. But it's like a puzzle. It's a giant puzzle. First of all, the love of the animal is number one.
Yep.
I mean, they are just so majestic and powerful. And like, my favorite thing to do is actually be in Saratoga at like 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, watching the horses work out, drinking a cup of coffee. Like, to me, I look forward to that all year long. Like, that week on my schedule is blocked off my calendar. Like, there's basically nothing that can
interfere
with that at all. And so, yeah, it's a complicated thing because a lot of people don't know about it. It's almost like you would relate to this. If you don't play golf, you don't understand the love of it.
No.
Okay, right?
Yeah.
You and I love to play golf. When you hit a golf ball correctly, there's nothing like it.
It's been a while.
You try to explain, right, exactly. You try to explain that to somebody that doesn't play golf, they're like, they look at you cross-eyed. Horse racing is the same thing.
It is.
That whole business, it really, you have to become part of it. But when I take people to like the Belmont Stakes, but they always take about 20 or 30 people every year, and they've never been to a horse race, or I take them to Santa Anita or some of these beautiful racetracks or Saratoga, they then become addicted to it. And not in a bad way, in a way that is they're much more interested in learning about it.
That's kind of incredible. I mean, that's...
Have you ever been to a horse race?
No, I haven't.
First of all, in the big races, Jeffrey, the fashion is 90%
fashion.
Of it. So you're like,
we love
that's
fashion.
Something that you love.
Started off talking about performance. Obviously, you performed at such a high level, TV, directing, everything, opening restaurants. And opening restaurants are severe on the body as well as on the mind. But I think that really one of the hardest things I know, we've known the same chefs forever, and we see what happened, but the wear and tear physically is just tremendous. How do you protect yourself from that? And I know you're a runner, and you've written some books about fitness and health. One of the first chefs ever by the way, to do that. What's your daily routine?
Well, I just came from Pilates class just now. That's where I was.
By the way, Pilates fixed my back.
Fixed it.
My lower back.
And
my neck.
I only started really doing it not too long ago, and I'm now addicted to it.
Yeah, because what happens is, as a chef, you're hunched over.
No, and also guys, in general, guys do not stretch.
They don't stretch. Never.
And so you need something to be stretchy, whether it's yoga or to me, Pilates is just
amazing. So that's the first thing. You don't run. You Pilates.
I do run. Well, I run less now, but I've always been a runner. When I was in high school, I was a distance runner. And then after I got out of school, I continued to run my entire life. I've run 4 marathons.
Really?
Yeah. But there is a lot of wear and tear to running every day. And there's a lot of wear and tear standing over a cutting board for 35 years, too.
Yeah.
And your neck and your back. I mean, it's just, you know. So I'm an early morning person.
Yep.
So I get up very early, and the first thing I put my gym shorts on, and I go do something.
Something.
Running. So now it's Pilates, sometimes yoga. I don't know. Because it jump starts my day. It makes me more productive. It opens my eyes up for the rest of the day. And it just helps me be creative and productive.
You also watch your diet. I remember about 10 years ago, you dropped quite a bit of weight.
Yeah.
And you just, I asked you, I said, oh, what'd you do? And you said, basically, I eat half as much. I eat the same thing. I just eat, my portions are different, which is fascinating.
I have a philosophy where I eat 3/4 of what's on my plate as opposed to all of it.
Yeah.
That's number one. So it's 25% less caloric intake. Calories in, calories out. I mean, let's face it. That's a big part of staying in shape, right? Number two, if it's not good, I don't eat it. And that's a mistake that a lot of people make, including myself, where it's like you just eat it to eat it, even if it doesn't taste good. Like, why should we eat something that doesn't taste good? We have those choices.
We do.
Right?
Especially chefs.
And then here's a big one for me. Late at night. You can't eat late at night.
You can't.
Listen, when I was at Mesa Grill and we were like rocking and rolling and we thought we were invincible, we would go out after service at midnight, go to Blue Ribbon and eat steaks and fried chicken and drinking bottles of wine till 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Not sometimes, all the time.
And no problem. You wouldn't gain an ounce.
Yeah. No, it got out of hand. I gained weight.
Yeah.
That's where I would get out of shape. Can't do it anymore. Can't eat it late at night.
Can't.